Welcome to the Body Intelligence Summit 2015, where top scientists, therapists, dancers, and body workers are coming together with you to discover the joy of embodied connection. We appreciate you sharing this information with your friends and family. And now, your host, Gay Hendricks.
Thank you so much, and welcome to the Body Intelligence Summit, everybody. It's a great pleasure of ours to be doing this with you for the second year, and we're so glad that you're joining us. I'm very excited to introduce our very first speaker, our special guest today, Dr. Dan Siegel. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about him and give you his website. Those of you that are following along on your computers and might want to take a look at his website, he has a particularly informative one. It's drdansiegel.com, and that's spelled S-I-E-G-E-L, drdansiegel.com. And one thing I really want to invite you to take a look at there that I found personally very useful is one of his free resources there is called The Wheel of Awareness. And it's a great introduction to how the mind-body works. And I had the pleasure of teaching with Dan a year or two ago and got a chance to do the Wheel of Awareness activity with him live, and it was incredibly illuminating. So, Dan, it is a great pleasure to have you joining us today. Welcome.
Well, Gay, it's great to be here with you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. And I want to tell everybody that's listening and with us on the summit today that Dan has lots of different resources available there. There are books and tapes and recordings and downloads and things like that, and I highly recommend that you take a look at all of the things that he has available for you. Now, I also want to let you know that and we are making this available free for a while after the summit is over, but for those of you that aren't able to make all of the sessions or want to have it in your personal library, simply go to bodyintelligencesummit.com/upgrade. Oh, it's a great pleasure of ours to have the opportunity to be with the thought leaders of our time, and Dan Siegel is one of the preeminent ones. I'll tell you a little bit about Dan from his background, and let him tell you what he's up to right now. He's a graduate of Harvard Medical School and did his post-grad medical education at UCLA in pediatrics and child, adolescent, and adult psychiatry. We kept him out here in California, and he's down also at UCLA still today, where he's director of the Mindful Awareness Research Center, founding co-director of that, and one of the investigators at the Center for Culture, Brain Development. He's a man with great insight and deep insight and broad insight, and so I want to welcome him onto our discussion floor here and ask him a bunch of questions that people have either sent in or that we've crafted. Dan, as you look over the whole broad range of your career and as you've created your theories, inventions, tools, techniques, body-centered experiences have you found to be most effective for people who really want to change their physiology, who want to really change their lives right now? What is the most essential things that you've discovered?
Well, Gay, first of all, thanks for having me. And the question you're asking is so important because the history of the field of psychotherapy so often got lost in words. So I think the first thing I would say in response to your question is something I couldn't even really put into words, but it would be the more we let awareness become filled with the sensations of the body, the more there's a window that's open toward well-being. And so we can talk a lot about, and of course, you know, we're doing this as a recording, and so we're using words. But we need to take a step back from words and realize that a lot of the change that happens in people is not just by what they hear or what they say, but by a deep process that happens within the body itself. And it also happens between people. So the second thing I would say, besides letting awareness become filled with the body, is that when we think about, let's say, a dance therapist or movement therapist, a music therapist, someone who's in occupational therapy, who allows this non-worded world to be prominent. It's a very important set of insights that come from people who work in those fields. And yet the dominant thing you see in the field of mental health are word-based approaches to therapy, often that are, you know, embedded in books that people write with words. So we need to realize there's this fundamental thing. And I guess the second thing I want to say that I've learned is words are really, really important and helpful, but sometimes they actually get in the way. So it seems kind of ironic to say it, but we want to use words to point out the limitation of words is, I guess, the best way to say it. And so you say, well, okay, well, if those are limiting, what is actually the deal? And now this gets to the third issue, which for me is one of the most exciting, which is that all of us work in the field of helping people develop and grow and meet their full potential, find a life of well-being and connection and meaning. If you put all that under the term mental health and started looking at all of us that work in this field, it's been a strange finding for me in this journey over the last 30 years professionally to come to the realization that we as a field, mental health, actually don't have a definition of what the mental means, what the mind is. And so this has sort of led me to go on this sort of quest to try to figure out what is this thing called the mind? How come the field of mind health, mental health, doesn't have a definition of it? And why is it that even academic fields that study the mind have resisted defining it short of just saying something like it's brain activity, which is an interesting but limited perspective? So we can get into that, Gad, but I just want to say these three things right out there, that body awareness is so profoundly important because it's a window, I think, into what the mind is truly about.
Appreciate you saying that, because, well, also just to shout out a word of appreciation to the folks who put all of this on, my wife and Lamara Hartwell, my wife Katie Hendricks and Lamara Hartwell, and the folks at the Shift Institute, along with Mark Metz from Conscious Dancer magazine, really dreamed up this whole thing in our living room a few years ago, the whole idea of putting together a virtual summit that people all over the world could attend free of charge. And it's really, to me, I feel such an urge to get this information out into the world, because my own life was shaped so differently because of my early encounters with things like even some of the basic things that I learned in graduate school, like basic relaxation training and those kinds of things, were really my first excursion into my body. You know, I came at it from a very intellectual place, and it was a whole discovery process that went on. It was kind of like turning on a light in a mansion that I didn't know I even owned. And I wondered, in that spirit, what some of your early moments of illumination were, where you said, wow, I could really use this, or this could really help me, or this could really transform the field of medicine.
Well, I guess for me, it would have been a number of things. One, when I was in medical school and the people teaching me, the professors, didn't focus on the internal subjective experience, like our feelings or our thoughts or our narratives, our meanings, our ways of understanding the world. They instead focused on the body, because we were in medicine, but they focused on the body as an object rather than a source of rich subjective life. So it's an interesting contrast, because for me, it was an opportunity to start looking at basically the idea that we have two ways of perceiving things. We can just perceive the body as an object and things in the world as things you can hold, tangible, objective things. But we can also see the world as being filled with sensations, meanings, deep reflections that are part of what we can call the mind. So for me, the first thing that I think really affected me was dropping out of medical school when I felt like something really, really wrong was being taught there. And on my time away, making up this word about the world of the mind called mind sight, the ability to see the mind and see that there's something real besides the physicality of objects in the world. So mind sight became, for me, a kind of a guiding light, and the relationship of the sensations of the body, not just the physical property of the body, and I think this is really an important issue, is that, you know, these professors who were teaching me, they knew about the body. They knew about the physical aspect of the body. That was their specialty. But they were profoundly misguided in teaching their students by example, and also by literally what they said, was that the body was just an object rather than a rich source of mental experience, of subjective feelings, meanings, ways in which we respond to the world with intuition, wisdom of the body. That was all missing. So to me, it's the mental side of the body that when you talk about conscious dance, let's say, or you're talking about movement or mindful movement, we're talking about the mind, really. All these things you're talking about, Gay, and even if we think about personal transformation, there are studies that are coming out in the last 3 or 4 years that are mind-blowing, literally, in that we now know how you learn to use your mind, not just what you say with words, but how you use consciousness, actually can improve your immune system, can change the level of an enzyme that repairs the ends of your chromosomes, telomerase, and it can also actually alter in an optimal way, it optimizes these molecules that sit on top of your genes to help prevent disease. So all those things now we know, the mind can change the health of the body.
Profoundly exciting, and there are a whole number of fields that are really looking into that. Do you officially call your field interpersonal neurobiology, or do you have a different name for it nowadays?
Yeah, you know, it's a term I made up years and years ago interpersonal neurobiology, so we still use it. It's a mouthful, so I sometimes just use a mindsight approach, but the idea of interpersonal neurobiology is if you combined every branch of science, math, physics, chemistry, biology, psychology, sociology, linguistics, anthropology, everything in between, if you combine all disciplines of knowing, and now beyond science, just to include also, you know, dance and music and poetry and prose and, you know, what do you do with religion and spirituality, all these ways of knowing. There are lots of ways of knowing in the world beyond science. So we started as a science interdisciplinary field, but now we basically include everybody and every way of trying to pursue truth. So that's interpersonal neurobiology, and we have these over 3 dozen textbooks out now for professionals. But the issue basically is to say, if someone's pursuing knowledge, how would we understand a view of reality based on all these disciplines being brought into one perspective? So that's how we approach the world, and it's a very exciting field to be in. From that, we also come up with a definition of the mind, which is as an emergent, self-organizing, that means it's part of a complex system beyond just the skull, but it's also embodied and relational. So it's fully embodied. So the flow of energy and information through the body, not just through the brain, brain's just one part of a larger bodily system, is essential to understanding the mind. But also you can go beyond the skin and realize the mind is also a relational process. So, you know, for what we're talking about here, Gay, the idea of body intelligence is central to the definition of mind from our point of view in interpersonal neurobiology, because we see the body as basically, literally, the embodied mechanism by which energy and information flows through us, and we see the mind as both emerging from that, so we call it an emergent property of this complex system, so it emerges from energy and information flow, but then it does something else besides give you subjective experience. It turns back and it organizes itself or regulates itself. That's called self-organization. So in this view, basically, we propose the definition of mind that then you can go on and say what's a healthy mind, and we see a healthy mind as emerging from self-organization that's optimized, which happens when you integrate a system. And integration is the linkage of differentiated parts. So for us, looking at body intelligence and body awareness and movement therapy and dance therapy, all these wonderful, beautiful, fantastic things that, you know, an intellectualized, word-based, you know, approach might look at it and say, oh, that's just body stuff or something like that. We would say just the opposite. We would say you're getting closer to the mind by getting before and beneath words. And so any developed discipline technique to help you become aware of the body's sensations is a gateway toward liberating the mind from patterns that may have been non-optimal. That is, they're not integrated and they tend to move you toward chaos or rigidity. So when you look at the brain side of this, just to look at those mechanisms, you see that the regions of the brain that are activated with body awareness are exactly the regions you want for insight into yourself, empathy for others, and the ability to regulate your emotions in a much more flexible way. This area includes the anterior insula, it includes aspects of the anterior cingulate, and even parts of what are called the orbital frontal regions. And when you look at all these areas that are basically behind your forehead and perform integrative functions in the brain, you realize that body awareness is a key to regulating the embodied mechanism of all that flow. And because it's also involved in empathy, you're connected deeply to a relational integration. So all that being said, body awareness is an absolutely essential starting place for transforming the mind and for integrating both the brain in its body and a person in a social world.
That point about the social world, one of aspect of your work that really caught my attention was your recent book, Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. And one of the things that fascinated me about it was that the process myself right now of writing a mystery novel, I've published, Hay House has published four of my mystery novels that are about a Tibetan Buddhist private detective. His name is Tenzing Norbu, and he goes by the name of Ten. And so they all have the word Ten in the titles. So the latest one, The Fourth Rule of Ten, sets up the one I'm working on now, which takes place when he's a teenager. So, of course, I wanted to go out and find out all the things I could about the teenage brain because I was trying to recreate what it was like to be a teenager, and it's been a while. So, anyway, I wanted to I found the book quite remarkable in many ways, but I wanted to find out, just because many people on the call may have not read it yet, could you give us a couple of minutes about what some of your key findings were when you're in your work with teenagers?
Sure. Well, you know, the Brainstorm book was the hardest book I've ever written because I wanted to write it for both adults who care for adolescents and for adolescents themselves. And there was nothing out there for an adolescent to read to understand her own brain or his own brain, or for an adult to share in a mutual understanding. So that's one thing that the book does. And the other thing is it dives deeply into what most people, including therapists, don't know about the science of adolescence, which is we have an entirely new understanding of the mechanisms that are beneath some of the maddening behaviors, maddening both for adolescents themselves, where emotions can feel out of control or social interactions can feel really confusing, all sorts of things that happen. And so when I went in to read the research, it's kind of things I love to do is, since I'm trained as a scientist, is to, you know, understand what the scientists who are doing the empirical research are telling us. And since I'm also a clinician, you know, try to translate that science to bring it to life in practical ways that people can use. So for the adolescent, what came up was the following four aspects of adolescence, which spells the word essence. I'm kind of an acronym addict. And essence is ES, is an emotional spark. And each of these basically are ways where the adolescent brain is remodeling during the period, let's say, between 12 and 24 years of life, about the second dozen years of life, more or less. So it's not raging hormones, that's a myth. It's not immaturity, that's a myth. It's actually a necessary remodeling period. And one of the outcomes of that is this emotional spark, which the downside is you can feel flooded by your emotions and confused. But the upside is life can be full of passion. So for 10, if you're talking about your book, Gay, you know, you really want to make sure that this struggle between emotions being higher and more intense, it's true. How do you actually kind of really harness the power of that passion? So that's the emotional spark of ES, of essence. The next part of essence is social engagement. And this is where basically the adolescent brain is changing in such a way that the adolescent is driven to push away from parental figures and sometimes even the larger adult world and really connect with peers. And the reason for this is it gives you the ability to have connections when you leave home and you're more likely to survive. The downside of it is in order to be a member of a social group, sometimes you give up morality. We call that peer pressure. So the idea of the upside of this social engagement is that, you know, relationships are the number one factor associated with our well-being as we go through all of life, not just adolescence. So learning the skills of having authentic, supportive, emotionally close relationships is something that starts in adolescence and continues on, and we want to nurture that as best we can. The next part of essence is novelty or novelty seeking. This is where literally changes in the reward system of the adolescent brain driven by dopamine are such that the adolescent is driven to try new things. The baseline levels of dopamine are lower and the release levels are higher. So it's not raging hormones, but it is a change in the neurochemistry of the reward system during this period. Now, why would that be happening? Because you want the adolescent to leave the familiar home. And there's nothing like novelty to get this adolescent to try something new, like what's unfamiliar, what's potentially dangerous. This is, of course, the downside is you can do things that are risky to get your dopamine released, and serious harm can happen to an adolescent or people around her or him. So this is the downside. How do you optimize this? You want to optimize the courage of this period so that you do try new things, but you do them with an awareness that your reward system is driving you to do things that may actually be dangerous. So that's a part of that whole process. And finally, the last part of essence is creative exploration. And this, you know, you probably experienced, Gay, in writing what 10 is up to as an adolescent, but this is the idea that we push against the status quo. And the brain is designed in its remodeling to basically say, hey, you know, I've spent the first dozen years of my life absorbing adult culture and adult knowledge, and that's cool. Now, I am in a stage where I'm going to push against the status quo. The downside of that is it can feel very disorienting and confusing, disappointing. You can feel dismayed. You can be really have a sense of despair, like what kind of world am I getting? The upside is for the individual that it's very exciting to do creative journeys and try out this way of thinking about the world in new ways. And for our society, I believe, the benefit of creative exploration is you can see that the major innovations in science and technology and art and music, they come from adolescent minds, and we forget that. And these adolescent minds have a wonderful essence, all this emotional spark, social engagement, novelty seeking, and creative exploration that drives us forward. And the amazing thing, just to finish this up, is when I was done writing the book, I realized, oh my God, these four elements of essence are actually the four significant factors that research has demonstrated to keep an adult brain young. So we should never give up our essence. We should maintain this essence of adolescence throughout the lifespan to lead a full and healthy life.
great, because one of the things as you were talking about all that, I was realizing we're all still teenagers. You know,
that,
if we can, yeah. Well, I know I didn't even start writing mystery novels until I was 65. And
there you
so
go.
One day I suddenly realized, yeah, hey, I want to go off in a new direction. And actually, Katie and I just finished in a new relationship book, a sequel to our book, Conscious Loving, for people in the second half of life. And creative exploration and creative emergence is one of the key principles that really people over and over again told us that's so essential in helping them stay alive and vibrant in their second half of their life.
Totally. Well, yeah, I think that's the essence. Absolutely. It's beautiful.
To ask you that you've got a broad reach across a lot of different areas. What do you see right now as the leading edge of your work vis-a-vis this field we're talking about body intelligence?
Yeah, you know, I think body intelligence needs to become a central part of the training of all mental health professionals. I know there are different schools of body intelligence, you know, and some focus on trauma, like Peter Levine. Some focus more on attachment, like Pat Ogden, that's your work. You know, and there's so much that I think can be brought together. That's kind of what I feel kind of my desire is to have us all kind of work together to find a foundational setting, because there's so much suffering in the world, and a lot of help can be created, I think, if we work together in these different fields. So for me, body-centered work is essential for the training of every mental health professional. And then in the broader field of mental health, in terms of what I'm up to, you know, I feel very deeply that if we honor the different approaches we've all taken, but find their common ground, which is so often not found, but is actually there, I think, when you look at the mind as this embodied and relational process, then people are focused on relationships, people are focused on the body, like you're doing, Gay. You know, you can bring them together when you see that the mind is both embodied and relational. I know that's not the way scientists usually talk, but I think there's a huge amount of science that supports that unconventional view, so we can come together to really help people lead more fuller and more vibrant lives, you know, by bringing the body front and center into the work.
I appreciate you mentioning that, because I feel exactly the same way. One of the things that's always concerned me about the professional fields in general is the incredible amount of siloization that goes on, where people will work in one particular little area and don't even seem to be in communication or even interested in integration with other fields. And so I really see this time as a time of increasing integration, and I appreciate your contribution to that.
Well, thank you. I mean, there's a kind of a stance in science generally, not clinical science, but straightforward science, that says we're here to study the world, not to try to improve it. And as a clinician, of course, your job is to try to improve the lives of people you're working with. So for me, being trained as both a scientist and as a clinician, I feel it's possible to bring the world together. And I think the siloization you're talking about exists in every discipline of human endeavor. That's for sure, whether it's religion or, you know, it's clinical work or science. Everybody finds their little tribe, and then they have their tribe against the other tribe. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, sports. It's what we do. The problem with that kind of in-group, out-group mentality is people who are needing help are sometimes not getting the help they need because too much energy is spent in competing across these silos. So for me, what's exciting is the possibility that while science may not be designed to improve the world, if we ground our work in science as clinicians, I think the siloization can be reduced. We can find a common vocabulary, a common ground. And from there, when we realize that, you know, healing, like love, is like candlelight. You know, if you've got a candle going and you light the wick of another candle, it does not take away from your candle. It doesn't take away from your flame. So we need to share knowledge. We need to share love and healing. We need to share this intention. And I think if we can get out of this more competitive, non-collaborative stance, we're actually going to realize that there's a lot of light you can bring into the world by sharing your flame. And I hope, and you know, people sometimes ask me, you know, what am I up to? I said, all I'm up to is like working to connect with people and collaborate with everybody, because everybody's got the flame inside of them. Let's now share our light with each other, and that's kind of what I feel like we all need to do.
Wow, beautiful. Well, along those lines, what do you see happening in the field? How do you picture our field 5, maybe 10 years from now?
Well, you know, the broad field of mental health, you know, including people who do body intelligence work and people who do narrative work, psychoanalytic work, specific cognitive behavior work, all of us, I think we have been limited in our own individual abilities and limited in our ability to connect with each other and appreciate each other because of this fundamental, often hidden fact that the mind, and we are all mental health professionals, has had no definition. Short of just saying it's brain activity, there's literally no definition out there. And I've asked over 100,000 mental health professionals, even in the field of education, I've asked 19,000 K through 12 teachers, and basically only about 3% get any kind of lecture that says what the mind is. So over 97% of us in mental health have never had a lecture on what the mind is. I never had one. So I think to say we're mental health professionals and not have a definition of what the mental is, of course, means we're out of our minds, right? We don't know what a healthy mind is if we don't say what the mind is. So I guess for me, 5 to 10 years from now, and I know this is wishful thinking because, my gosh, I've been at this since the early 90s. So how many years is that now, Gay? That's almost 25 years. You know, I know things that are like really big boats which have inertia and they keep on going in their same direction. The various siloed fields of mental health, clinical work, and the science beneath mental health, different fields of psychiatry, psychology, we've all been going along without this definition of mind. So my deep hope is that in the next 5 to 10 years, if someone's got a better definition of the mind than the one in interpersonal neurobiology we offer, cool, let's talk about it. But I'm telling you, after doing this for over 2 decades, when I bring up this definition of the mind, which has support in the sense that it's predicted the outcome for future empirical research on relationships in the brain, so it's had predictive value and continues to have predictive value, for example, talking about integration and emerging from self-organization, even though it's had that, you don't see people getting in a state of mind saying, oh, yeah, that's right, we've been working without a definition of what we're doing. Let's try what happens when we have a definition of the mind. So I hope, and I don't really claim to have a insight on how to make this happen, but my hope is somehow people can wake up from their slumber and realize, you know, to have a field called mental health, which has had no definition of the mental and therefore cannot have a definition of mental health, if you're not saying what the mind is, let's stop the madness and actually really talk about the issue. And if people don't like this particular working definition that we've proposed from our field, that's fine. Then let's come up with another one. And let's find one, because to not have a definition of the mind, I think, has really seriously limited us and made us kind of look silly in the public's eye, and has been the source, I think, of a lot of fighting about who's right and who's wrong, because no one's actually saying what the thing is they're trying to help develop well. So that would be my hope. And I know it sounds like a small thing, but, wow, let me tell you, there's so much scientific tension about it to say the mind is more than just brain activity. But I think the body is fully what the mind is about, as well as relationships. So we need to try to, I think, put those into a definition of the mind.
That's very profound, because I agree, and it it sounds simple, but it's actually such a fundamental issue down at the ground floor of so many of our different disciplines that, let's hold an open heart for that to emerge over the next few years. Given everything you've talked about, Dan, what is one thing, now that we're kind of winding things up here on this conversation, what is one thing that you'd really like to leave us with today, or a next step our listeners can do to make changes in their lives?
You know, I think if you start really simple, life has gotten super busy, super information dense, and really we get distracted from, I think, four mental experiences. And what do I mean by that? With the body, I think if people take 5-10 minutes a day to simply allow the sensations of the body to fill awareness. Now, some people in the field of, you know, mindfulness, and I'm, you know, helped found our research center here on that focus on mindfulness. Mindfulness would be basically the idea of letting awareness be filled with present moment experience. Now, there's a lot that can happen in the present moment, and a lot of ways you can let go of judgments and prior expectations and, you know, be present for life. So presence is what arises when we allow, starting with the body sensations not to be something that's just categorized as, oh, that's my foot, or that's my breathing, or, but actually let the richness of the here and now sensory flow fill you. And if you do that, just let's say 5 minutes a day, if you've never done it before, if you do it 5 minutes a day, move it up to 10 maybe 12, you know, you'll find that this capacity to be in the flow of sensory experience, which in the brain has a kind of lateralized circuit that helps shut down the more midline circuit, which is busy, chatting and making you worry. I call it the oat circuit. It makes you worry about others and the self. If you can be with sensation, you'll find some freedom from anxiety and depression. It's amazing, but I think it works by this reciprocal influence of these two circuitries. Now, it's fine to think about others and the self. That's really important. But the issue is that can take over, can be too differentiated. So integration, I believe, is the base of harmony. It leads to well-being. The way we start by differentiating our sensory flow is to let the body's signals fill awareness, and saying to our chattering mind, later, you know, I'll attend to you later. So it's not that it isn't important to think about the self and others. That is important. Making sense of your life is very important. Autobiographical reflection is very important. All sorts of studies support that. The idea is we're sometimes too much doing that. So the body is a gateway to the present moment. And if we just took a couple minutes every day and did a regular practice, some people call it a mindful awareness practice, but it's just this basic, simple thing of saying, let the sensations of the body be the focus of my attention. Let it fill awareness. And when I get distracted, let me return to that sensation of the breath, the bottom of my feet, my hand, whatever it is. You'll find transformation will begin to occur. It's kind of amazing. And you mentioned earlier, Gabe, you know, we have this wheel of awareness practice. If you go to my website, you know, drdansiegel.com, you'll find for free this wheel of awareness practice. We've had way over 500,000 people download this and gotten feedback from not just people who've downloaded, but also people in workshops that do it. And, you know, the experience over and over again is how transformative it is to empower yourself to systematically let the body fill awareness, let sensations from the outside world fill awareness, give yourself time to focus on others and the self by looking at all that circuitry, but also realize how deeply interconnected we are, not just with other people, but with the planet. And so this is kind of a one practice. You do it, you know, regularly, but it's all in one. You get body awareness, you get awareness of the outside world, you get awareness of mental experience, you get awareness of your relational world, all within one practice. And you know, whether I'm doing that in a workshop or there was a big 40-year anniversary of an institution specializing in meditation, and we did the wheel, and even though these people have been meditating for decades, it was a profound experience for many people there too. So it's good for beginners, it's good for experienced people, and it's totally based on the idea of integrating consciousness. So it comes from a scientific and clinically informed background, but then it gives you transformation of your life. So that's, I guess, what I would recommend.
One of the reasons, Dan, that we were so eager to have you as the first keynote speaker in this Body Intelligence Summit is that you're a living example of the, and your work is a living example of the kind of integration that we want to have happen. One of the key intentions for the Body Intelligence Summit is to integrate a number of different disciplines that often don't have a chance to talk to each other. Everyone from, you know, well-known medical doctors and authors such as yourself to folks that may have been a yoga teacher in a particular discipline and doesn't really have much back and forth with the rest of the different fields. And so it's an opportunity for a lot of us to come together, and we're really appreciative that you gave us your time and energy and wisdom to help get this second Body Intelligence Summit going. So again, it's drdansiegel.com, drdansiegel.com, the Wheel of Awareness activity, and a tremendous amount of other resources that are available there. So many blessings to you, Dan, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Gay. It's been really great, and I deeply am honored by being a part of your wonderful program.
Thank you so much, and thank you all for listening. As I mentioned earlier, we have nearly 100 countries, folks from nearly 100 countries in on this, and what a great session with Dr. Dan Siegel to start with. We have a number of options available for you. Be sure and check out the BodyIntelligenceSummit.com upgrade. All you do is go to BodyIntelligenceSummit.com/upgrade and see what's available for you there. Help support the summit in lots of ways that way. So thanks again for your interest, and be sure to join us for the next session. Thanks a lot. This is Gay Hendricks.
Thank you for joining us for the Body Intelligence Summit, brought to you by the Shift Network. For more information about joining our global community dedicated to helping people awaken to their divine humanity and take inspired action, visit www.theshiftnetwork.com. To learn more about the Body Intelligence Mastery Kit, the online collection of top experts on body intelligence, or to add all these interviews to your personal library, visit www.bodyintelligencesummit.com/upgrade. Thank you for sharing this summit with your friends and family. We appreciate your dedicated support.